and to Yerushalayim, your city, return in mercy. Dwell within it as you have spoken. Build it soon in our days. Well, long doesn't really mean eternal, but all right. Long lasting for a period of time. Throne of David, quickly prepare within it. This is your Hashem, builder of your shrine. Now, first of all, what does it mean that Hashem, God, dwells in your shrine? Obviously, God doesn't have any particular locality, not limited to a particular place. God fills the whole of the universe and transcends the universe. So, we have to do something to make sense out of these words.
Just like he chooses to dwell on earth, he chooses to dwell, you know, like in Yerushalayim, which is, you know, he's him.
Well, but what does it mean? Does it mean that he's not in New York?
No, but it's more concentrated in your shine.
More concentrated. What would that mean? Can we think of him as a kind of hydrochloric acid, you know, and think
no,
of...
No, but...
So what does it mean?
That Hashem is more revealed.
That's the standard understanding. That he reveals himself more there. He shows himself more there.
Talking about Shekhinah?
Yes. Talking about Shekhinah, but Shekhinah can be somewhere invisible also. The Shekhinah follows us into exile, but isn't always revealed.
Is more of a dress in exile? Like more of a...
More what?
As more of a dress in exile?
You could put it that way. Okay. You could put it that way. That's right. More covered up. More covered up. If you take a look... Page 573. This is Pirkei Avos, chapter 5, Mishnah 7. 10 miracles were performed for our ancestors in the Holy Temple. No fly was seen in the place where the meat was butchered. Now, the temple involves a large abattoir. Animals were slaughtered, the blood was taken off, the animals were butchered, the skins were flayed off the animals, the internal organs had to be inspected to see whether they were kosher or not. That will attract flies. Swarms of flies. There were no flies there. The rains did not extinguish the fire on the altar pyre. The fire had to be burning all the time, even in the wintertime. It can rain in Jerusalem. This year, Baruch Hashem, we've seen. And it can rain, and it rains strong. But it never managed to put out the fire. The wind did not disperse the vertical column of smoke from the altar. The smoke is going straight up, and the wind is blowing, and it doesn't affect it. Now, these are open miracles. Anybody who wanted to see Hashem's presence could go to the temple and observe these miracles. So that's what it means, at least on one level, to say that he dwells in Yerushalayim in a way that he doesn't dwell elsewhere. So, back to the blessing 109. return to the city, dwell in it, and rebuild it. Now think about the order. What the order is telling us is, don't think that God needs two buildings to dwell in. We're not building buildings for God to live in. We're asking him to return and dwell in the city before we talk about rebuilding it. What we want is his presence to be felt there. Gemara says the following idea. We have a day in the calendar where we commemorate the destruction of the two temples, the ninth of Av. We're told that remember now whether it's the first or the second, but the enemy came in and destroyed the city and committed all sorts of atrocities on the temple grounds. And on the ninth of Av, towards evening, set the temple on fire. And the temple burned the whole night of the tenth, into the day of the tenth, until noon. So the Gemara says, the Yehuda says, if I had been there when they established the day to commemorate destruction, I would have said to make it the 10th. Because that's when it really burns. It really burns the night of the 10th into the day of the 10th until noon. But the rabbis disagreed. The rabbis said, the beginning of the destruction is what needs to be commemorated. The question is why? It was maybe an hour or two, but it started to burn on the 9th, and all the rest burned on the 10th. Why is the beginning the time that has to be commemorated? So, one of my really great teachers, Rav Soloveitchik from Boston, said, based on Gemara Kedushin, how could the enemy burn down God's temple? How could they have any control over it? A place about which it is written that if the high priest on Yom Kippur goes into the Holy of Holies and has an inappropriate thought, he immediately drops dead. How could the enemy burn it? The answer is that God's presence had already left. God's presence had already left. Since his presence had already left, they're burning down a building. We have no interest in buildings. What do we care whether there's gold and silver and tapestries and copper and other things there? What we care about is that God's presence was manifest there. So what we're commemorating is the absence of his presence. That's what we're commemorating. The building of the building is just a symptom for us. Similarly here, what we ask for is the return of his presence. Yes, we are told by the prophets that part of that process will be that the city will be rebuilt. Good. But that's not the first item on the agenda. First item on the agenda, he should return, take up his residence there in the sense that I just described, and then we ask him to rebuild it. The rebuilding is a vessel to hold his presence. Now maybe, with that idea, you could begin to understand why we feel that it's still appropriate to commemorate the destruction of the temple. About 8 years ago, there was an article published in the Jerusalem Post, written by an American conservative rabbi, who said that Tisha B'Av should be discontinued. How can you commemorate the destruction of the city when you see right in front of you that the city is rebuilt? Well, from our point of view, that suggestion is worthy of a conservative rabbi. But when you look at the bricks and the pavement and the gold, and you see that it is configured into Muslim houses on the Temple Mount, and into a stadium in which Jews pretend to be Greeks, and orchestra halls and art museums where more Jews pretend to be Greeks, and a building in which the government pretends to be Greek. This is not the rebuilding of Jerusalem that we are talking about. What we are talking about is a rebuilding to house God's presence. And that you do not have here. We identify the rebuilding with its spiritual purpose, not with its physical form. That's why we don't think at present we are experiencing the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And we still ask for it to be rebuilt. You with me? Now, there's another ant. What happened? Nope, I have to cancel what we said before. Certainly not a symptom of its being later and different from all the others. Question is why, I didn't think of it, good for you to point it out. This is why does this have an ant and that has an ant? That has an ant because churches are going to do it. Here? I don't know. Unless it's a quotation. That's the other thing I can think of. That it's really a quotation. And in the quotation from the Tanakh, there's a vote. But now I don't know. Thank you for pointing that out. Don't know. Okay. Another thing is, notice that the throne of David is last here. Here you see that the throne of David is really only a symbol. It's only a symbol of another much greater reality. The throne of David is not the means to bringing about the building of Yerushalayim. The Yerushalayim comes first. And it isn't the high point, because God's returning to the city is far more important than the throne of David being established. So in the first three clauses you have the essence of what we want. The throne of David is then just a symbol of those greater realities. It's not in and of itself the great reality.
When you said Olam doesn't mean eternal, long lasting, why?
Maimonides in the guide points out that Olam in Hebrew does not mean forever. Forever is lo'olam va'ed. Lo'olam means for some designated period of time. For example, if you buy a Jewish slave, he's supposed to serve for 6 years and go free in the seventh. If in the seventh year he doesn't want to go free, because he has a wife, because he has children, doesn't want to leave them there, because you gave him the wife and the children, and don't belong to him really, and he enjoys working for you, you treat him well, then he can go through his procedure whereby he's allowed to stay with you longer. And it says, V'avadol le'olam. He shall serve him forever. Now, first of all, no person can serve another person forever, because he's going to die. Right? And second of all, Chazal say that the olam means until the Jubilee, until the Ovid. But where do they get that from? How can they take a word that means forever and turn it into a Jubilee year? That might be 2 years later. If he's fought them 2 years before the Jubilee year, they'll only serve for 2 years. The answer is, Olam does not mean forever. Olam means for a certain designated period of time. In the context, you'll know what kind of time it is. And that's why in Hebrew you have a longer phrase, Olam Fa'et. That really means forever. So says my mother. That can be forever. Hare, the rebuilding of the temple is part of this phase of history. But eventually, the whole world will pass to another phase of history where there'll be no more sacrifices, people won't eat and drink, and the soul and the body will be related in different ways. Right? That doesn't go on forever this way. So to say forever, to say eternal, that's really very extravagant. Nothing of our world as it is today is going to last eternally. So it's funny, the word Olam doesn't really mean that. Okay, now comes Davidic reign. This is really the Messiah. Now here the literal Hebrew tzemach means like a plant's growth. Tzemach is plant's growth. Of David, your servant, quickly caused to flourish. Now in the Hebrew it's the same word, tzemach and tatzmiach. Means let the plant growth grow. And his horn, which they translate salvation, but here it's the horn, like a ram's horn that you blow through, shall be raised up in our salvation, or with our salvation, with your salvation, for we are hoping for your salvation all the day. Now, blessed are you, Hashem. In the closing, you combine the two metaphors, what's called in English a mixed metaphor, who causes the horn to plant grow. The horn of salvation to plant grow. So what you have here are two different metaphors, two different images, with two different meanings, and in the closing, the two images are pushed together. The first one, as you all know, plant growth is very slow. Very slow. And steady stages. Of course, it varies in its rate, but overall, it's very slow. This refers to the fact that the salvation may come through very slow, gradual stages. There may not be an abrupt, rapid historical transition. That might not happen. It could happen by slow, steady degrees. On the other hand, the symbol of a horn, you have the picture of the person blowing the horn and the armies gathering together and going off to war. That's a very rapid process. And as I've told some of you, our sources are not clear and not consistent on how the final stages will take place. Maimonides says, for that reason, no one knows how it's going to take place. It's something that's impossible to know. The verses in the prophets are vague, ambiguous, and contradictory, and there's no oral tradition, says Maimonides. No masorah on this subject. That's why there's so many differences of opinion. Because there's no clear tradition how it's going to happen. So the blessing year has mixed together two of these possibilities, either like plant growth or like blowing the horn. The closing puts them both together so as not to give one precedence over the other, even though the literal words of the closing give you what's a mixed metaphor where you're applying plant growth to a horn, which really isn't the same thing. What is David's claim to fame? Why is it that we want him to reappear and take the position? Because he has the quality, the title of God's servant. God's servant. In other words, as I told you when we talked about justice, how can we ask that God alone reign over us when we're asking for the restoration of the judges? Isn't it the judges who are going to exert authority and power? They are. But since they're doing it as God's representatives, when they do it, it's God reigning over us. So here we're asking for the Messiah, for Davidic reign, as we say in English here. But because David has as his title, your servant, it means that through him you will be reigning over us. And then, as someone asked me on the way out yesterday, the ultimate salvation that we will have will only come with the Messiah. Short of the Messiah, we are always in danger, and anything can happen. Anything can happen. Yeah.
Why say your salvation? Isn't it our?
Oh, so the you are here means coming from you, rather than coming from someplace else. Yeah, you're saving us, but the you are here refers to the subject, not to the object.
How is the word translated here as pride?
Tikva?
Huh?
Comes from Tikva?
Karen?
Comes from, no.
He's asking about Karen.
Oh, pride, sorry.
They understand that it's a metaphor, so the person who blows the horn is making it clear that he's there and that he's, you know, certainly not hiding himself. He's taking a public position. But it's another metaphor, so another symbol. But I think you can apply it more directly to, I've seen this in the commentaries, you can apply it more directly to the idea of salvation. Okay. Yeah.
Why does it say, to, I don't know if it's in English, I mean, it says tarum, like to raise up, Yeshua Zecha. It sounds like it should be, and your horn you should blow, and
yeah.
If it was a banner, maybe you should raise it up. Like
yeah.
Before.
I don't know. It could, the problem is based on a verse someplace that I don't know. But you're quite right to ask to whom. We do use that phrase. Okay, here in your version, just in my head. Yeah, this might be better for the translation of pride. But I don't know what raising up your horn has to do with your pride. Does the horn have to do with your pride? Alright, let's see. Okay, now we come to an extremely important and problematic blessing. Hear our voice, Hashem our God. Mercy on us. Accept with mercy and favor our prayer. Will you hear prayers and supplications? And from before you, our King, do not turn us away empty-handed. Will you hear the prayer of your people as your mercy? Now, I want to focus for the moment on do not turn us away from you empty-handed. Let's figure this out. It's the king's birthday. So he says, for each of my favorite helpers, I'm offering three requests. If they're reasonable requests, I'll grant them. So, the Prime Minister comes and he says, O King, what I want, first of all, is a palace. He says, okay, reasonable. And I want an extra month's vacation during the year. Reasonable. And the third thing I want as Prime Minister is that you should grant my first two requests. I think the King is going to be a bit upset. I offered you three requests, and you wasted one. You made two. And the third one, you just asked to fulfill the first two. Now here, we went through 12 particular blessings of asking God for various types of help. And now, here we say, Don't turn us away empty-handed. I suppose that means, give us what we asked for. No, but you already asked for that. So why are you asking again? It's completely redundant. Indeed, in a certain way, that's the focus of this blessing. I think that there's something very important going on here. I have to understand what kind of exercise a request is, what it means. I'll give you an analogy. You are in serious need of $50. You go to your friend, someone with whom you're close. Say, listen, I'm in trouble, I need $50. Please lend me $50. He says, $50 for you? No. No. I'm not lending you $50. Fine. You walk out, you reach the public sidewalk, right on the sidewalk at your feet is a $50 bill. U.S. dollars. You needed the $50? You got $50. Now, is everything okay? No. Oh boy, you're going to be faster, I tell you. No, not everything's okay. Why? Because your friend said no. Your friend said no. Still have to calculate that. Okay, you have the $50 of what you need. What about your friendship? In asking for the $50, there are two things going on. One is, I need the $50 for whatever purpose. And the other is, I need a confirmation of our friendship, of our relationship. Now, I think that's part of what's going on here. We ask for protection, and we ask for help, and we ask for parnasa, and we ask for in gathering the exiles, and all the other things. Each one we ask for because we need it. Finally we say, okay, we made a lot of requests. Will you answer them? Won't you answer them? Chances you'll answer all of them, maybe very, very slight, but don't turn us away empty-handed. Because in addition to needing each one of those items that I specified, I also need to feel that you're there. I also need to feel connected to you. I also need to feel that we have a relationship. So don't turn me away empty-handed. Yes, there may be some things that, for whatever reason, you're not going to give me. But don't turn me away empty-handed. That makes this an entirely separate petition. Petition to feel the connection. Okay, now, let's go back to it again. Hear our voice. And take pity and compassion on us. First of all, there is a position in which God, so to speak, doesn't pay attention to a person altogether. It's not that he isn't aware of what's going on. He's, of course, aware of everything that's going on. But as an item of concern, as an item that is part of the purpose of creation, not everything is equal. Monday night we spoke about trust and endeavor. And I mentioned that this is five categories. I said, fifth category, a person becomes like a cow. He can have a very happy life, happy, satisfied, tranquil, pleasant, because God has given up on it entirely. Cows also have pleasant lives. Plenty of grass, they're protected from disease, make sure that they don't get upset because that changes the taste of the milk. No problems, because he's a cow. Shmako Lenu. Let me go one step further. We spoke once about remembering. The beginning says, Zocher Chasdeyavos, God remembers the loving kindness of the patriarchs. What did I tell you there about Zocher, about remembering? I raised the question that if it says God remembers, doesn't that imply maybe he forgets or could forget? Why do you say he remembers? What do we say?
He's a past fact to make a decision.
He's using a past fact to make a present decision. The score in Hebrew does not mean to remember as opposed to forgetting. It certainly doesn't mean remember in, after having forgotten. And the proof of it? Where did I prove it from? That that's what the word the score means in Hebrew. From the book of Esther. Because after Ahasuerus removes the queen, it then says, and Ahasuerus remembered the queen, remembered what happened to her, remembered what he did, and then went about getting a new queen. That does not mean that he forgot her in the interim. Forgot what happened to her. But as I said, it means, as he says, it means using a present fact for a past fact for a present decision. Now, when it says that God sees something or hears something, it means he's using a present fact for a present decision, as opposed to lizkor, which means using a past fact for a present decision. So, when we say to God, hear our voice, that's not opposed to not hearing the voice, but rather missing it, and, you know, not knowing it. But it's rather, let our voice be central in the deliberations you're undergoing to decide what to do now. Let it not be a fade out into the background, you know, where it's of no concern, like the mooing of the cows. And receive in mercy and favor our prayer. This is another key idea. What does that mean? Receive our prayer. What did we say almost 2 weeks ago, which would be relevant here? If I say to God, receive it, then what am I doing with it? I'm giving it. See, that's good. That's the way to go about it. Start in the simplest, you know, six-year-old level. It says, receive, so that means I'm giving. Follow it up, literally. No, I'm standing there asking God for all my needs. What am I giving him? Where is there a giving in prayer? So what do we say at the very beginning? Probably the first shift. Nobody remembers it.
I think we said with the word baruch, that baruch both means blessed and the source of blessing. So when we're praying, we give Hashem blessing.
Okay, that's true. That's true, and it's relevant. I said something even before that. Even before that, which is an easier idea to put in here. Easier, more direct idea to put in here. The men of the Great Assembly established the prayers to correspond with Kabbalas, with the sacrifice. So we ask, what kind of correspondence is it between sacrifices where, whatever they mean, we're taking things and presenting them to Hashem, the direction of flow is from us to Him. Whereas, in prayer, we're asking Him for things. How could you coordinate one with the other? How could you say that they're established corresponding to one another? As performances, as gestures, they're running in opposite directions. So what do we say? What do we ask for in prayer? Things that help us to serve Him. That's what we should be asking for. Resources with which we can serve Him. Now, someone who says, please give me resources to serve you, what kind of relationship between the two is he expressing when he says, please give me resources to serve you? What's his goal? Serving. That's his goal. That's why what he's asking for is resources with which to serve. But what he's expressing is, I belong to you. I'm offering myself to you. I'm giving. myself to you. In the petitions of the Shemona Esrei, the gesture is offering oneself to God. That means that Shemona Esrei, when you express the words of the prayer, you are engaged in sacrificing yourself to God or offering yourself to God. That's why prayer and the sacrifices in the temple are really flowing in the same direction. Both are flowing in the direction of Shemona to God. Okay, if the prayer is expressed in the meaning of offering oneself to God, here we ask that offering be accepted in faith. That the offering be accepted in faith. This is something you ask about every offering. Ratzon means favor. Ratzon means the person is pleased with and accepts what you've done. So here we say, accept with compassion and favor our prayer. It is being an offering to you. For you are a God who hears prayers and supplications. You hear it because you accept it. And then we say, don't turn us away empty-handed. So the order here is very important. My gesture is to offer myself to God. And because I do that, and because what I ask for only the means by which I can serve Him, then I can hope that He will answer me. The main qualification I have in my prayer that I should be able to be heard is that the prayer is my offering of myself to God. This illustrates an idea which comes up very often. I'm not going to go into it now here anymore, so I want you to know it. It's sometimes upstairs in the 4 o'clock shiur, I do it, 4:30 shiur. If you want something from God, the only leverage you have is to quote God against Himself. You're not going to move God by bringing up considerations that He hasn't thought of, or considerations that He's not on record that He's in favor of. You're not going to outsmart God. You're going to teach God something. But if you can say to God, please give me X, because you're on record that you want A, and X is a means to A, that's a relevant thing to say. You find that when Moses argues with God, always, always, he makes use of principles, ideas that God is on record as being in favor of. So Moses says, you yourself are on record for ABC, taking ABC into account, this thing shouldn't be done. Yeah.
Isn't that still somewhat smart?
Okay, you're right. You're right. But in these cases, God invites us to express ourselves. He invites us to express ourselves. He wants to know what reasons we can put forward for what it is we're asking for. So, all the way through, the reasons that we can use are values that He has expressed Himself being in favor of, then they're good reasons for us to use to move Him. I mean, this is not it's not really restricted only to God. If you want to get somebody to do something, how do you do it? You try to figure out what he's interested in and show him that this thing is also part of what he's interested in. Right? And how else do you build a bridge between this thing and him? Say, this will immensely improve the appreciation of Bach. So he'll say, Bach who? Why should I care about that? So what? But that's not going to be a good reason. But if you tell him this will immensely appreciate increase the appreciation of Shabbos tranquility. Oh, that's something I'm willing to invest in, because Shabbos tranquility is important to me. When you want somebody to do X, what you do is you build a bridge between him and X and show him that where he is, X is where he should be going. So vis-a-vis God, you've got to use things that are what he's on record as wanting. So, since he wants us to serve him, That's what he created us for. And I'm asking for things in the spirit of asking for means by which I can serve him. Then I can say, accept my prayer, because my prayer is my self-sacrifice to you, my offering of myself to you. And then, in that spirit, don't turn me away empty-handed. Okay, so the order works out very well. Okay. Let's see the next one on 111. That'll be enough today. Temple search. Be faithful. This means to accept in favor. Same word we used in the previous one. Jewish people and their prayer. Restore the service to the Holy Holies of your temple. And the burnt offerings of the Jewish people and their prayer in love you should accept with favor. This word favor comes up and up again, over and over again. And the service of your people should continuously be in favor, receive in favor. And let us see, let our eyes see your return to Zion in mercy. Blessed are you, Hashem. Returns his presence to Zion. Now you understand, this blessing didn't always have this text. Because this blessing, this slot, existed during the Second Temple. So at that time, we were not asking for a restoration of God's presence to Jerusalem. At that time, it was there. Also, to the bit of redundancy here, we asked for our prayer to be accepted in favor in the previous blessing. Now we're asking for it again. Let me start with one general observation. You will hear over and over again people who say that the prayers replaced the lost sacrifices. You will hear people who misquote, misunderstand the guy who took the place of Maimonides. He said that prayer is much better than sacrifices. Sacrifices is slaughtering animals. It's barbarian. But we have graduated to the position where we relate to God spiritually. Now, that's absolutely absurd. Because every time you pray, weekdays, Shabbos, holidays, Yom Kippur, you say this blessing. And in this blessing, you ask that the sacrifices be restored. It's insane to suggest that prayer as a spiritual interaction is superior to the sacrifices, and we sort of, privately, when no one's looking, chuckle that the temple is gone, and we're happy it's gone because now we've graduated to a more spiritual living. If in every prayer we ask for the sacrifices to be restored, the temple to be rebuilt. But this blessing, when the temple was standing, I don't know if we have the original text, but given what we have said, this blessing must have said, accept the offerings that we give in the temple, and maintain your presence in Zion, so that it would be strictly parallel to the previous blessing. The previous blessing said, accept our prayer. And now we're saying, accept the sacrifices. Why? Because as we said 7 minutes ago, God and the men of the Great Assembly set up the prayers corresponding to the sacrifices. And as we said 2 weeks ago, that means that prayers and sacrifices are a single, coordinated exercise. They're a single, integrated institution. It's all prayer, it's all sacrifice, it's all offering. The priests do their part representing the nation in the temple. The rest of the nation does its part in prayer. It's a national self-offering to God. And we are expressing our hope that that offering will be accepted in favor. And it has two parts. It has the part that we, the rest of the world, do, the prayer, and it has the part that the priests, our representatives, are doing in Jerusalem. And yes, I know that the priests are Shluchei D'Rachmanit. I'm still our representatives, is correct. Okay, now.
Yeah. I mean, what about the other one we talked about, Jerusalem? I mean, if it's in the Second Temple, they're saying we're building Jerusalem.
Yeah, same thing. It didn't have that effect either.
So it's to maintain Jerusalem?
Yeah. Maintain your presence in Jerusalem. Right? It didn't say come back to Jerusalem, and then no, maintain it, strengthen it. Yeah. Yes, yes, there's no question. What's going on here is this. That's why I started by telling you that this is not the text that was originally here. The text that was originally here, when the temple was standing and when the sacrifices were in full operation, it didn't say, restore your service to your Hall of Holies. It was not restoring. It was not new restore. It was going on. Right? So here, this is the blessing that would have said, please accept in favor the sacrifices that we are offering in your temple. But now that we don't have it, so in that very blessing, which would have said, accept in favor the blessing, the sacrifice we offer, that blessing goes back and repeats the idea of restoring the blessings. Right? The subject is accepting the sacrifices in favor. Now, we're not going to eliminate the blessing altogether. We're not going to change the subject of the blessing. So what are we going to say? Right? So it's true, it's a repeat of what was said before. No question.
But like the actual process of doing the service, that's something we do. So shouldn't we be like asking Hashem to enable us to restore the
service? That's what it means. You know, when you say to they have these fights over football teams. You know, and the guy in Oakland wants to buy the San Francisco football team. So San Francisco fans are upset, you know, and incensed. I'll say he buys it, but the team was over there. Say to him, passed on. Offer him double and bring back the team. Now, they're not saying that if you offer him double, unless you go down there and carry each one of the team members back on his shoulders. What it means is, if you'll lay out the money, they'll come back. You're setting up the conditions under which they can come back. So we say to him, you bring them back, because you're the one who's holding it back. You're the one who's the last cog in the wheel that's preventing it from happening. Okay, I didn't do the words in this, but we'll do that next week.